Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
This is Le Show, and the time has come for another discussion at some length about water in New Orleans, and also because of what's been happening recently, the big part of the United States that sits on top of New Orleans. And today it's my pleasure to have a friendly acquaintance. We don't know each other enough to be real friends yet, but we're getting there. And a fellow member of an organization or two, and a distinguished scholar of these subjects, John Barry, best known, I think, outside New Orleans for being the author of Rising Tide, the seminal study of the 1927 Mississippi River flood, but best known here in New Orleans for being a stubborn and smart and persnickety advocate of a better and smarter way of dealing with some of these problems, and now a member of the Southeast Louisiana. What's the formal name of the organization?
Well, the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, as opposed to West.
But that's the acronym would be.
I don't know that it has an acronym. No. We've never been able to figure it. Everyone just calls it the Levee Board.
Okay,
after Katrina, there are several different levee districts that handle the metropolitan area, because they're obviously different parishes. Each one has an. And they didn't consolidate the districts, but they consolidated the levee boards. So we now oversee several levee districts in the metropolitan New Orleans area.
First of all, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for the introduction.
My pleasure. And let me start there, because an awful lot of people who comment to me when I blog about these subjects on the Huffington Post and just in conversation seem to be of the opinion that what happened in the Katrina event, some of the blame for that can be laid at the feet of the, quotes, corruption and cupidity of the old levee board. Was there anything that the levee board, even in the bad old days, could have done to prevent what happened?
Well, actually, there's one decision that they were complicit in, but it had nothing to do with cupidity, maybe stupidity, but not cupidity. You know, the levees are 100% designed and built by the federal government, 100%. However, the Corps of Engineers did not want to make the drainage canals, part of the things that failed in Katrina, part of the system. They wanted to put gates to your audience. These drainage canals carry rainwater out of the city into Lake Pontchartrain. And the Corps wanted to seal them off from Lake Pontchartrain, which is what they're doing now, so that lake water, storm surge, the ocean goes into the lake and then could go into these drainage canals. The Corps did not want to expose those canals to storm surge, and the Orleans Levee Board fought that idea because it would have added expense to the Orleans Parish, the city of New Orleans, and they were successful because they had friends in Congress who took care of it. That, however, had nothing to do with the design of the flood walls along the canal. If it had actually been a greater storm, and Katrina was a great storm the way it hit the Gulf Coast, but what destroyed New Orleans, what devastated New Orleans, was actually not a great storm. It was 100-mile-an-hour winds. The storm surge wasn't that great on the lake. And the flood walls that failed in front of a storm they were designed to hold easily, in fact.
They were advertised to hold.
Yeah. It was just a bad design. There were actually experiments done by engineers who work for the Corps in Vicksburg that concluded these flood walls would fail exactly, you know, the way they did fail, the precise mechanism of failure, but that information was never conveyed, although it was published, but the information never made it to the people actually building the flood walls or designing the flood walls.
What was the date of those studies?
Oh, the 80s. 19 wow. Year, you know, mid-80s. before the plans were finalized. So that's just bad management, incompetence, terrible design. Nonetheless, if the lake had been shut off from those canals, which we are doing now, then that part of the city, which is most of the city really that got devastated, would not have been flooded.
Are those studies the basis of federal Judge Stanwood Duvall saying that the Corps knew that its system would not hold? Is that is that what he based his finding on?
I don't know. I haven't read his decision, yeah. So I can't really comment on something that's, I don't want to take the lawyerly
Well, you're not
response.
A lawyer, and you don't play one on TV, so.
Well, just today, as Harry and I were talking about this as we were coming over here, for the first time, our levy board, we inherited billions of dollars in lawsuits. In fact, we're being sued for $200 billion.
Wow. That must make you feel good.
Oh, it's really cool. But today we got the first lawsuit actually filed against us. So now we're like grown-ups.
Oh, yeah. It's like a bar mitzvah for the levy board.
We
in New Orleans have learned to look askance when something is described as a natural disaster based on our experience with Katrina. Was the flooding in the upper Mississippi basin this year a natural disaster?
Well, a little bit of both. Obviously there was more rain than the system could handle. The question of how well the system was designed and what contributions were made by man to the disaster, that gets a little bit more complicated. I think to a large extent, though, these were local decisions rather than Corps of Engineers decisions. In fact, one of the problems is that there's no coordination on the upper part of the river and the tributaries and between different jurisdictions, even to the extent that there's no information exchange, so that there's no central point that even knows where all the levees are, how high they are, how well made they are. And obviously, if you're trying to figure out a flood fight or where the water is going to create the most problem, and you don't even know how high a levee is or how well made it is, then it's pretty difficult to plan your defense and coordinate and build a system. And after the 93 flood, there was actually a terrific study by the White House that was hailed by everybody. It was hailed by agricultural interests. It was hailed by barge interest shippers on it. It was hailed by environmentalists. Everybody agreed it was a great study. And they came out with something like 84 recommendations, and only one of them was any action ever taken on.
Well, one out of 84 is good.
Yeah, that was on about flood insurance, and it's obscene, really. So you had the flood in 93 on the upper Mississippi, which was significantly greater than this year's flood, vastly greater, as bad as this one was. Mm. You had Katrina. We now have this flood in 2008. And frankly, the country still does not have the will, the political will, to do anything. And indeed, after Katrina, the Congress ordered the Corps of Engineers to take an inventory of the levees around the country. And the Corps started this in 2006, but then Congress stopped appropriating money for them to do it. Now, so it's only 2 years after the law passed, and they already stopped appropriating money to pay for this inventory of levees.
Was that the program under which the Corps came out with that report last year that said there were like 126
yes.
defective levees, including in the Sacramento Delta of California?
That's correct. And Sacramento is, the next disaster waiting to happen.
And friends of mine in Sacramento know that.
Yeah. And there are people there are developers who want to build land that is 20 feet below sea level there. This is much lower than any point in New Orleans. In mm-hmm. fact, this is kind of off the direct line of questioning, but it's relevant. People talk about New Orleans being below sea level. The actual data is that just over one half of the city, and I mean just over, like 51%, is at or above sea level. But sea level is a little bit of a misleading way of approaching the question, because New Orleans is a major port. So it starts at sea level. Virtually every major port in the world, and absolutely every major port in the world that's built on an alluvial river like the Mississippi, is you start out at sea level. So as soon as you develop it, you start effectively draining the land, so you sink below sea level. Mm. You know, anybody who's ever flown into the airport outside Amsterdam has landed about, I think it's around 13 feet below sea level, lower than any point in New Orleans. You know, Rotterdam, Amsterdam, Tokyo, a third of Tokyo is below sea level.
Mm.
Two-thirds of Osaka is below sea level. Lagos, below sea level. It isn't just New Orleans. If you have a port on a river system, it is going to be below sea level. The question is what you do to protect it, because you need to have the port. People around the country don't realize Pittsburgh is a port with direct access to the ocean because of the Ohio River to the Mississippi through New Orleans. Tulsa is a port with direct access to the ocean. And it's actually it's not a tiny port. And the value of New Orleans is to make the whole interior part of the country accessible to the ocean and to shipping, which is a hell of a lot cheaper than rail or truck.
Especially now.
Another thing that people don't realize, you hear of the Lower Ninth Ward. First, it's called the Lower Ninth Ward because it's downriver, not because it's low ground. Some of the ground is as high as any ground in New Orleans. Well, the Lower Ninth Ward was flooded by the Industrial Canal. That is a man-made canal. It's a canal. People dug it. And it was flooded by the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway.
Another canal.
A man-made canal. These are for the shipping industry. The Gulf Intracoastal Waterway was actually built to protect shipping from German submarines in World War II. It stretches from Texas to Florida.
Well, but it's worked. There hasn't been an attack by German submarines in years.
That's exactly right. It's been very effective. If it weren't for these canals, this area would have been dry. It would not have been flooded by Katrina. And the benefits of the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway is the entire country. It's just the connection through the Mississippi River system to the rest of the country and to the national interest. I mean, these are reasons why I personally, and I think most people who are informed, realize that it is a national responsibility to protect the city, because these attributes, such as the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway, that benefit the entire country, have actually made New Orleans more dangerous. That New Orleans, naturally, before they built these things, was not particularly vulnerable to hurricanes, certainly no more than any other coastal city, and much less than most coastal cities, because it's...
We had the wetlands as a buffer.
Exactly.
More with John Barry moments from now here on the show. But first, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
2 weeks in a row, Jesse Jackson delivers himself of an apology about the same incident. This week, quote, "I'm deeply saddened and distressed by the pain and sorrow that I have caused as a result of my hurtful words." This is, closing the quotes for a moment, this is because it became known this week that in the off-air, on-mic, whispered episode in which Jesse Jackson spoke disparagingly of Senator Barack Obama, he, Reverend Jackson, used the N-word. Quoting again, "I apologize again to Senator Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, their children, as well as to the American public. There really is no justification for my comment, and I hope that the Obama family and the American public will forgive me. I also pray that we as a nation can..." Jesse Jackson. We'll be waiting for next week's apology. Pope Benedict the XVI has apologized to people sexually abused by members of the clergy in Australia. He raised the issue during a ceremony to consecrate the altar of St. Mary's Cathedral in Sydney. The Pope has been participating in World Youth Day activities for a week. That's a long day. I would like to pause to acknowledge the shame which we have all felt as a result of the sexual abuse of minors by some clergy and religious in this country, Pope Benedict said. Indeed, I am deeply sorry for the pain and suffering the victims have endured, and I assure them that as their pastor, I too share in their suffering. These misdeeds, which constitute so grave a betrayal of trust, deserve unequivocal condemnation. They have caused great pain. They have damaged the church's witness. Can I get a... unquote. He also said victims should receive compassion and care. The recent weeks have seen a case exploding on Australian television news in which a victim of priestly sexual abuse had his complaint rejected by the Archbishop of Australia, who was in possession of a report saying the event happened, and was in possession of a report saying that the same priest committed a similar act. The Archbishop said he rejected this particular case because he'd had no reports of similar conduct by the priest in question. Pope didn't specifically address that. UBS executive Mark Branson surprised the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations, UBS, the giant Swiss bank, by saying that the world's largest wealth manager would stop offering offshore banking services to U.S. clients, oh crap, through branches in Switzerland or other areas that aren't subject to U.S. regulations. Quote, UBS genuinely regrets any compliance failures that may have occurred, said Branson, chief financial officer of the Global Wealth Management Unit. On behalf of UBS, he continued, I'm apologizing and committing to you, the Senate, that we will take the actions necessary to make sure this does not happen again. So now we have to manage our own wealth, ladies and gentlemen. The Oklahoma... Hey, attention all Nebraska Cornhusker fans. The Oklahoma Publishing Company and a sports writer this week sued a Nebraska football fan who admitted creating a fake internet article about two University of Oklahoma quarterbacks. OPUBCO and sports writer Jake Trotter sued James Conrad, the alleged perpetrator of the hoax, accusing him of libel, copyright violations, and trademark infringements. Conrad published a defamatory article on the internet July 9th that falsely stated Oklahoma quarterbacks had been arrested for intent to distribute cocaine. Conrad is a Nebraska fan who works as a computing services manager in the Information Technology Department at the University of Texas. Last week, Conrad admitted to Oklahoma columnist in a telephone interview that he was responsible for the hoax. He said he wasn't thinking. I want to express my deepest apologies to the families of the quarterbacks, Conrad said. I didn't want to hurt anyone. He added, I think anonymity brings out the worst in people. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast.
This is LeShow, and we're talking with John Barry, who is the author of the acclaimed book about the 1927 Mississippi River flood, Rising Tide, and secretary of the East Bank New Orleans Levee Board. I'm going to give it its brief name. Your study of the 1927 flood, I think, is essential understanding for people who want to know what the history of this place is. And based on that, and people have seen Spike Lee's movie, people have heard from a lot of other sources, rumors believed to a greater or lesser extent by a lot of folks here, that based on noises people heard and other things, that there was some deliberate dynamiting or other attacking of the canals, the flood walls,
right,
the levees.
Right.
Do you have any data at your disposal?
Yeah, I mean, I personally was on that the Industrial Canal levee. I was inspecting it with Ivor Van Heerden, who ran the state of Louisiana's forensic team. And it was entirely obvious what caused that collapse. The flood wall was overtopped, and when the water was pouring, like in Niagara Falls, over the top of that wall, flood wall, which looks like these noise, you drive down an interstate highway and they have on the side
the noise barriers to protect the
right.
suburban
That's exactly what the flood wall looks like. and it's probably about as strong. Anyway, when the water poured down the top of that flood wall over a period of time, it ate away at the earth that held that flood wall in place. And then the flood wall collapsed. Now, I don't doubt that there was an enormous noise. You know, when a flood wall 20 feet high suddenly topples over because of the force of that water, that's going to make a loud noise.
Mm.
And the water itself is enormously loud. So I can understand why someone would say they heard an explosion. But I was personally on that levee. It was totally obvious that levee was overtopped and gave way because of the overtopping. You could argue, again, engineering. They did not put some sheet piles that are supposed to anchor that flood wall. They didn't put it deep enough. It's supposed to be 60 feet. They decided to make it 17 feet. And, you know, that may have been a stupid decision, but at least that levee did what it was designed to do. You know, it wasn't designed to hold that water.
Mm.
Whereas the flood walls on the 17th Street Canal, the Orleans Canal, Avenue Canal, the London Avenue Canal, those things just gave way in front of a flood they were supposed to hold. They were not overtopped. The water on those canals didn't come any higher than 2 feet below the top, but that was still enough pressure because of bad design and perfectly good construction. In fact, this is another thing about the Corps' stupidity. One contractor actually sued, and, you know, it's funny. Normally I go on shows and find myself defending the Corps, and I'm not known as one of the Corps' harshest critics, though I've certainly criticized them. But this was dumb. You know, a contractor who was building that flood wall in one of the spots told the Corps what they were doing wouldn't hold. The contractor told it. And he sued the Corps, trying to get the Corps to build a better product that would work. And also, of course, to get more money for it. And the Corps fought his lawsuit and won. And they never sent any engineers to evaluate his claims. It was entirely done by lawyers.
Well,
you know, the result is what we have.
When you need flood protection, call a lawyer.
Yeah.
So now we hear here in New Orleans reports about seepage into the neighborhood on the so-called protected side of the newly rebuilt, newly refurbished 17th Street Canal. And we see pictures in the paper of puddles and Corps saying it's brackish, it's coming from seawater, meaning it's coming from the other side of the flood wall, or in some cases saying it's not brackish, but saying in either case it's nothing to worry about. And I think there's a historical memory in this town of a year and a half before Katrina, homeowners in pretty much the exact same location were saying, hey, there's water bubbling up in my lawn on that side of the 17th Street Canal flood wall. And Corps officials were saying, it's nothing to worry about. Are we reliving the past here?
I hope not. And as a member of the levee board, actually, you know, we're obviously quite concerned about this. To the Corps' credit, they've changed since Katrina. They are, by a wide margin, the best federal agency or any governmental agency to deal with since Katrina. Far better than any other federal agency and probably better than a state or local agency. With us, they've been responsive. They've been extremely helpful. When we've had questions about something and said we'd like them to do a peer review and have some experts come in, they've done it. And there are some explanations for the seepage that are, you know, which is what the Corps believes, that you know, are nothing to worry about and that will eventually go away. We don't know that they're right. So we have asked, as the levee board has actually not just requested, we've said we need people independently looking at this and telling us what's wrong. Is the Corps correct or are the critics of the Corps correct? We will find out the cause of that, I think, relatively rapidly.
I have, you know, just a layman's acquaintance with all these subjects. My sense of what's been going on the last 3 years is that the Corps has repaired the parts of those levees and flood walls that breached. But have they done anything to the parts of that structure that didn't breach?
On the Industrial Canal and the Gulf and Dragosa mm-hmm. Waterway, Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, those things have been protected from overtopping. And you can understand the difference that a hurricane storm surge is not like river flood can last for days or maybe even weeks. A hurricane storm surge is a matter of hours. So if you can protect the levee from overtopping for a few hours,
you've done your job.
Then, you know, it will survive. The water goes away and you're okay. And all that, the only water, you'll get water, you'll get some flooding, but only the amount of water that goes over the top, like over the lip of a bathtub. And that could create some problems, but it's certainly not a disaster or much less a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. So they have done that. The biggest change, however, has been on the drainage canals. They are, I hope this isn't getting too technical for listeners who don't have a sense of the geography in New Orleans. Again, these drainage canals take rainwater into Lake Pontchartrain, which sits north of the city.
These are like three fingers from the lake.
Exactly. And the lake, it's certainly not as big as the Great Lakes, but it's a big lake. It's, you know, 50 miles long and more than 20 miles wide. It's almost a bay with direct access to the Gulf of Mexico. So the main thing they've done is put gates at the mouths of those canals so that the water from the lake cannot, and from a storm surge coming through from the Gulf of Mexico, cannot get into those canals anymore. So even if they haven't dramatically improved the strength of the walls along the sides of those canals,
they're keeping the water from getting in.
They're not going to be stressed the way they were before. Mm-hmm. Now, as a board, we are still not happy with this, and we have been pushing them to improve the walls and the canals anyway for redundancy. On the other side of the city, where the Industrial Canal runs from the Mississippi River to Lake Pontchartrain, and then we have these shipping channels that go out, one parallels the Gulf Coast inland, and, you know, we have a little bit of a bigger problem. There will be a gate eventually that protects that region from storm surge coming up from the Gulf of Mexico.
Is that part of the 100-year plan that's supposed
it
to be
is.
Done by 2011?
2011, yeah. And there will be an interim gate that will be finished by next hurricane season. But this year we're still vulnerable right there. But that gate will be an enormously significant addition to the flood protection for the city.
Now, when we talk about a 100-year event, people who've been following the news in the Midwest know that there have been 200-year events in the last 15 years.
Right. It's an idiotic way of describing risk. It's just stupid. And even before this, actually, I was talking to people at the National Academy of Sciences and in the Corps of Engineers about the terminology, and I'm not the only one. Other people have realized this is a stupid way of thinking about it because people hear 100-year storm, which means it's got a 1% chance of hitting any particular year. And it just sounds like, well, if I'm protected against a 100-year storm, I don't have to worry about it. But that's not the case. I personally would like the terminology to change so that we talk about somebody's lifespan. You know, if the average lifespan in the U.S. is now, call it 80 years, it's not quite, but for round numbers, what is the chance during somebody's life that they will see a catastrophic event like Katrina in their community? And the reality is, in the rest of the world, they laugh at the standards we use in the U.S. I mean, in Holland, they protect against river floods using a standard of a minimum of a 250-year flood going up to a 1,250-year flood. That's for a river. And for the ocean, they use a standard of protecting against a 10,000-year flood. And in Japan, depending on how populated the area is and what the economic value is, they go anywhere from a 100-year flood to a 10,000-year flood.
Mm. Now,
protecting against a 10,000-year flood sounds like it's over the top and something you don't really need to worry about. But if you translate it into a lifetime event, a 10,000-year storm actually has almost a 1% chance of occurring in the lifetime of an average person. A 100-year storm has roughly a 60% chance of occurring in the lifetime of an average person.
Well, there are people here who've seen two of those, right? Betsy and Katrina. And
yeah,
some have seen three in their lifetime lifespans, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
right.
That sort of proves
but
out.
But at what level? Obviously, we never had a disaster as bad as Katrina before.
Right.
Part of that was the engineering, but the storm itself, it was an enormous storm. The Gulf Coast got hit by a storm surge that was 28 feet. That's as big as the tsunami in Asia.
And speaking of tsunamis, once again, news of the warm. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Yes, this is Le Show. Climate change will pose substantial threats to human health in the coming decades. That's not Al Gore saying that. That's the Environmental Protection Agency issuing its warnings about heat waves, hurricanes, and pathogens just days after the same agency declined, at the behest of Vice President Dick Cheney, to regulate the pollutants blamed for the warming they say will pose substantial threats to human health. The EPA says it's very likely that more people will die during extremely hot periods in future years, and that the elderly, poor, and those in inner cities will be most at risk. Other possible dangers include more powerful hurricanes, shrinking supplies of fresh water in the West, who needs that, and the increased spread of diseases contracted through food. Strong warnings coming from the EPA. In the West, it found changing weather patterns could thin the snowpack that feeds rivers, affecting hydroelectric dams and water supplies in coastal areas. It could bring a sea level rise, we've just been talking about that, that eats away at dry land, and storm surges that can wash the land away in a flash. In Washington and other eastern cities, the report said a warmer climate is likely to produce more bad air days. Welcome to the club, boys and girls, because heat speeds up the process by which exhaust byproducts are cooked into smog. The report also found that rising temperatures are likely to mean more periods of sustained summer heat. Yeah, it's going to be hotter. It's going to be hotter sooner in the year than it was in the past, said one of the report's authors. She said young people living in Washington, for example, will notice a difference before they reach middle age. They're going to look back and think about how nice the summers used to be. Well, people always do that when they look back on their youth, don't they? Oh, man, the summers, they were so nice. But wait, there's more. The loggerhead shrike, once common, is now severely imperiled. Hundreds of species of birds, including many once common songbirds, such as the meadowlark and bobwhite, are in severe decline in the United States, falling in population by as much as 90% since the 60s, scientists and government officials and conservation groups told Congress this week. The chief cause is destruction of habitat, scientists said. They said rising food prices and the push for alternative fuels are putting intense pressure on farmland set aside for conservation. Other killers include invasive plant species that take over the native nesting sources, wind turbines located near critical flyways, whoop, there goes another bird, lighted and glass-encased buildings, lighted cell phone towers, domestic cats, disease, pesticides, and climate change, which is also shrinking habitat ranges. That's quite a list there. I don't know if we can handle everything on that list. We can get rid of domestic cats. I know that. Don't you dare. Farmers racing to plant corn for ethanol, which is subsidized by the federal government, pulling millions of acres out of the nation's private land conservation program. Even green building codes that aim to make structures environmentally friendlier, mainly by conserving energy, pay no attention to bird destruction, says Karen Cotton, a bird crash specialist. Now, they never told you about that job and career day in high school, did they? You could be a bird crash specialist. At the American Bird Conservancy, Cotton said as many as 975 million birds are killed by crashing into buildings each year. Many migrating species of neotropical songbirds, which breed here and winter in the Caribbean, you know, that's a good life, are attracted to internal and external building lights as they migrate at night. The light fields entrap night migrating birds. A new analysis suggests that biofuels grown in the tropics are not a much greener source of energy than drilling for oil, at least in the short term. The research paints an even gloomier picture of biofuels than previous studies, which have begun to cast doubts on the greenhouse gas benefits they might provide. Plants that produce palm oil or corn ethanol recycle carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow, but two studies published in Science suggest that the carbon benefits from biofuels are delayed for centuries when farmers knock down carbon-absorbing forests, like the rainforest, in order to grow the plants. One estimated that cutting down Brazilian rainforest to grow soybeans for diesel fuel would result in a so-called carbon debt that would take 319 years to repay, essentially rendering the fuel as carbon unfriendly as gasoline in the short term. To get a better sense of just how green biofuels are, Holly Gibbs, a tropical land use scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and colleagues used new data on the yields of 10 crops in various seasons and ecosystems within the rainforest areas. Even when Gibbs assumed the plants would perform in the top 10% of all global varieties, with corn ethanol varieties way out producing what they currently can, the picture remained gloomy. Oh, don't be gloomy. Put on a happy face. It's warm outside. Shrinking sea ice is significantly increasing the rate at which icebergs scour the Atlantic seabed, a study released Thursday of this week has found. Yes, even the sea has to sleep somewhere. About 80% of Antarctic marine life is found on the seabed, and these scours crush the animals and plants living up to 500 meters below the surface by the ice. They do promote biodiversity by creating space for marine animals to live. Too many scours could change the distribution of key species and affect the type and number of creatures living in Antarctic waters, researchers warned. The number of ice scours is expected to increase as global warming continues to reduce the size and duration of winter sea ice. The study was published in the journal Science. And add kidney stones to the growing list of possible consequences of global warming. A new study warns that as many as 2.3 million more people may develop the stones in their kidneys as a result of warming. There's a greater risk they will be subject to dehydration in more sultry climes, which is believed to be a major contributor to stone formation. This in proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. But wait, there's... there's more right here.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general.
The federal government has dropped two investigations into the inspector general overseeing Iraqi reconstruction projects. He was the guy that was finding all the waste, fraud, and abuse, so of course they opened an investigation into him. In a July 3rd letter, federal prosecutors said they closed the criminal investigation of Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. No charges being brought. Mr. Bowen is gratified this inquiry has concluded, says his lawyer. He's gratified. And Bush administration initiative to defend the nation against a smuggled nuclear bomb or biological outbreak or attack. Those initiatives remain poorly coordinated, costing billions of dollars, while basic goals and policies remain incomplete. That's according to new reports by congressional investigators. It's the grown-ups. I blame the grown-ups. Clean, safe, too cheap to meter. The French nuclear giant Areva this week confirmed there was a radioactive leak from a broken pipe at a nuclear fuel plant in southeastern France a week after a uranium spill at another of its plants polluted the local water supply. The latest incident comes as an embarrassment to the French government, mon Dieu, as it struggles to contain environmentalists' anger and reassure residents near its nuclear plants that they are safe. Meanwhile, a Scottish beach contaminated by nuclear waste is a radioactive minefield that should be closed immediately, say the worried locals. Sandside Beach, an attractive bay 2 miles west of a decommissioned fast breeder reactor. 5,000 particles have been accidentally discharged from the reactor's crumbling storage shafts, with many being washed ashore at the popular beach spots. It's just radioactivity, babe. And the U.S. government has calculated a new total cost to open and operate the nation's first nuclear waste dump, over $90 billion. It's too cheap to meter, because you don't meter the cost of the dump. It's the first official estimate since 2001, when the figure was $58 billion. So the cost of building it has doubled, and they haven't started building it yet. Now, any of you who've dealt with contractors know what the next chapter of that story is. The Energy Department official in charge of managing Yucca Mountain, Ward Sproat, disclosed the new number to reporters this week. It includes $9 billion already spent, and covers about 100 years of operation until the dump is sealed up forever. And that won't cost anything, because that's cheap. News of the warm and of your nuclear power miracle to come, ladies and gentlemen. It's all copyrighted. Don't worry about it. This is Le Show.
Once again, we're talking with John Barry of the New Orleans Levee Board and author of Rising Tide. Let me backtrack just to give people a greater understanding. That when you said the levee boards were merged and reformed, what was the difference in the composition of the membership of the old levee boards and your colleagues?
Well, the old levee boards were purely political instruments. And in fact, they were actually reserved in some cases by statute to be appointed by local politicians. The new boards, there's actually a nominating committee which is made up of deans of the colleges of engineering of every university in the state and, you know, good government groups. They form a nominating committee. People have to apply to be on the levee board. By law, we have to have 5 engineers on the board. One of our people on the board is a past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. We have a PhD hydrologist, expert on soils and, you know, the movement of water through soils. We have, you know, a former head of regional U.S. Weather Bureau. So he's a very skilled meteorologist who in the past has made hurricane predictions. So this is really one of probably the best qualified board of its kind in terms of technical expertise in the country. Frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. I mean, all the engineers are skilled. We've got one lawyer. I'm not really a technical person. In fact, not only am I not really a technical person.
You're not a technical
I'm
person.
I'm not a technical person.
But you're a smart person.
Well, you know, I've been involved in policy, and I think there's a place for that. So, you know, I can go talk to congressmen maybe in more easily or at least communicate more clearly than some other members of the board. And, you know, plus I have access to the media. And frankly, that's a useful tool.
Yeah. Are you paid?
Oh, yeah. We get every time the board meets once a month. We get $179.
Cash?
No, it's not cash, but the checks haven't bounced yet. Mm. We can get 44 cents a mile, too.
Oh, good.
Fortunately, I'm not president of the board because our board president probably works. I am not exaggerating. I would guess he puts in 35 to 50 hours a week on this.
Wow. You're
and
secretary?
I'm secretary. I probably put in somewhere between 10 and 20 hours.
Mm.
And I don't think, frankly, that any of us, if we had realized what we were getting into, I don't think any of us would have volunteered. But I don't think any of us, you know,
You're not quitting.
No, we're not quitting.
Back to the rating of protection. What would it take to say people on the upper Mississippi, people in New Orleans are going to get engineering that provides so-called 10,000-year protection as opposed to 100-year protection?
Well, it would take a lot of money, which would take a lot of will, which would take a lot of, you know, political, you know, you have to name your priorities.
What's the total of the damage done in Katrina and the Mississippi River floods this year? Do you know?
Well, that's too rational an approach.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll go goofy now.
After any disaster, we have this urge to pour money in. And 2-3 years later, people have already forgotten about it. As indicated, we were talking earlier, in 2006, Congress ordered the Corps of Engineers to start inventorying levees around the country. And the Corps started that. But already, Congress has stopped funding that program. It's still on the books, but they didn't give the Corps any money to do it.
And the reason?
It just wasn't a high enough priority for this administration, nor did Congress step in. You know, money is tight.
I guess the bottom line is this city is lurching along a kind of very slow-motion recovery.
I think it really has picked up, though, in the last 6 or 8 months significantly. Part of that is money from Road Home finally started to flow.
That's the homeowner assistance program that the state has run.
And one of my favorite lines is yours, that the illusion of leadership is more dangerous than lack of leadership.
Yes, we do not labor under that burden.
There is no illusion that there is any political leadership here. So people do recognize they have to do it themselves, and they are doing it themselves.
And you live here.
I do.
And do you feel a certain twinge every June 1st and a certain relieved exhale every November 1st as the hurricane season begins and ends?
Yeah, sure. I'll feel a lot better in a couple of years when the 100-year protection is in place. The reality is, for the most heavily populated parts of the region, 100-year protection is actually better than 100-year protection. It's approaching, you know, 400 to 500-year protection, which begins to almost be reasonable. Now, that's not the entire region. But, as I say, the most densely populated areas of the region will have, they don't yet, but they will have effectively much better than 100-year protection.
We mentioned in passing at the beginning the matter of the coastal wetlands, which have historically acted as a protective buffer for this city from the coastal impact of hurricanes and which have been eroding and dying away. Does the levee board get involved with issues of the wetlands restoration, or is that outside?
Well,
your...
a little bit, but the restoration project is really being run primarily by the state. And we say wetlands. The reality is all this land that melted away, some of it is every bit as solid as where we're standing, or it once was solid. It's not just marsh. What people don't understand, the Mississippi River carries a lot of sediment. It actually created all the land from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, your good friend Rush Limbaugh's.
Yes, sure. Just sign that big $400 million deal.
Yeah, well, Rush is from Cape Girardeau.
Yeah.
And all the way from Cape Girardeau to the present mouth of the Mississippi River, that land, roughly 35,000 square miles in 7 states, was made by the deposit of sediment. So if you step off the main street in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, that land is just as solid as some of the land that has melted into the ocean down here in Louisiana. Mm. So we've lost roughly 2,000 square miles, which is about the size of the state of Delaware. If you put the state of Delaware, wrap it around the city of New Orleans, then New Orleans doesn't need any levees. It's fine.
Hmm.
You take that land away, and New Orleans is suddenly very exposed. That's why I said earlier that nature did not leave New Orleans particularly vulnerable to hurricanes. It was actually fairly safe, particularly for a coastal city. But man has intervened, and things that we've done, such as the navigation channels, have had an enormous impact on erosion of this land. Other things that have eroded the land that have also benefited the entire country is the oil industry. They've cut 10,000 miles worth of canals and pipelines through the coastal marsh. And that let saltwater intrusion has very rapidly led to the erosion of a lot of this land. And even there are dams in North Dakota and South Dakota that were built in the 50s and 60s to generate electricity and to irrigate those areas and provide some flood protection. And those dams actually have withheld one-third of the sediment that used to go down the Mississippi River. So you take in one-third of the natural flow of sediment is actually in the Dakotas. That it used to come down here, and it's not in the river anymore.
And the rest of it gets dumped off the end of the continental shelf, right?
An awful lot of it for the shipping industry. The jetties carry what remains off. So between depriving Louisiana of sediment and drilling for oil and the shipping industry, you know, that is why Louisiana's lost so much land so rapidly.
And the last question I want to ask you is, when I talk about this with friends sometimes or people who email, sort of a glib response will be, well, what difference does it make? Global warming is going to raise sea levels and it's all going to go away. What do you say to that?
Well, it's it's really kind of funny. And the irony is that New Orleans is in better shape regarding rising sea level than most coastal communities. The reason is the marsh is alive, and the marsh will adapt to rising sea level and rise with the sea level if they get the sediment. If they get enough sediment, they will adjust and rise so that instead of that land going underwater, a lot of it will just get higher. Not all of it by any stretch. But that's still a lot better off than a place like Miami or New York. You know, New York, if you're on a rock, there's nothing that's going to grow. It just goes underwater. But because of the way this land was built and the sediment in the Mississippi River, there is the potential for the adjustment here that does not exist for much of the rest of the world, really. And it is a great irony, but that doesn't mean that rising sea level does not threaten New Orleans. And as you build, or we build, a flood protection system, obviously we need to recognize that, you know, rising sea level is a real threat. And as we speak, the Corps of Engineers is working on a fairly detailed plan. They came out with an early draft of it in May. They're supposed to be finished in November. They're actually supposed to have finished it last November. But it's complicated.
Novembers are Novembers.
Yeah. On that one, I'll give them a pass. Okay. You know, they were told to deliver in November, but it's enormously complex technically. It's more important they do it right than they do it fast.
As a New Orleanian and as a official involved with this, are you basically optimistic, pessimistic, or neutral?
Well, like almost everyone else in the city, you know, you have your good days and your bad days. And it used to be you'd have two good days in a row and four bad days in a row. But it's been more recent. You know, I'd have four good days in a row and one or two bad days intermittently. I had a recent bad day, and that was when the Congress passed the supplemental appropriation without much of a break for Louisiana in terms of 100-year protection. In fact, I think we got screwed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bush, to my way of thinking, certainly broke his promise.
The Jackson Square promise?
The Jackson Square promise.
Yeah.
you know. But it's not so much that he broke his promise; he just forgot to tell OMB about it, and he allowed his budget people to pretty much slash and burn. To give you a sense of what I'm talking about, St. Bernard Parish is immediately adjacent to New Orleans. It's just a boundary drawn in the dirt. There's no physical difference. And you can't protect New Orleans without protecting St. Bernard, because earlier we were talking about building gates to keep storm surge from coming into New Orleans. Well, those gates are actually built in St. Bernard Parish. However, the plan that the administration has would require every family in St. Bernard to pay roughly $60,000 in taxes in the next 3 years just for the levee system. That's their cost share.
And this is an area that whose housing was 99% destroyed.
This is not exaggerating. Every single home in St. Bernard Parish was flooded. Mm. Every single home. There were almost 70,000 people living there. And most of those homes were completely destroyed.
John Barry, thank you for being smart enough to know this stuff and being clear enough to explain it to me and I hope our listeners. And it's a great pleasure to have you on. I hope I can call upon you again as time goes on.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. It is a pleasure, and I'm a fan.
Thank you. Keep your feet dry. Meanwhile, back in Southern California, from the Los Angeles dog trainer, this correction. In Thursday's California section, forecast high temperature for Southern California beaches was listed as 145 degrees. It should have been 75 degrees. That's good editing, babe. That's going to put the sealant on this particular edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radio. Have they merged yet? Around the globe via the internet at two different locations, live or archived, whenever you want it on your computer, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download for members at www.audible.com/theshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like us getting through another hurricane season in New Orleans if you'd agree be with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh, San Diego, and Hawaii desks, and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans, which still doesn't carry Le Show, and to Jeffrey Talbot at AudioWorks here in New Orleans for helping to make today's show possible. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions that originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.